Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put a little context around the numbers, some perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices that face us day to day in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, Cape Town Airport's e-hailing crisis erupts amid violence and intimidation. No transparency, no trade as new EU rules raise the bar for South African exporters. China is rewriting its trademark rules and South African brands could pay dearly if they move too slowly. And a new homegrown app is putting a hard number on the hidden financial cost of being a woman. It's Wednesday, the 26th of August. Now, e-hailing tensions at Cape Town International Airport, I understand, have escalated now into allegations of assault, intimidation, and foreign drivers being prevented from entering the staging area. Now, an entity called Operation Ubuntu says institutional failure has allowed legitimate driver grievances to be hijacked and is now demanding urgent intervention. Organizing committee member of Operation Ubuntu is Indipili Matini, who joins me now. Indipili, welcome to you. Maybe let's just start with Operation Ubuntu. What is it and who's given you the mandate?
Operation Ubuntu is almost a coalition of organizations such as the Afana Sonke Action Campaign, the African Inclusion Campaign, and we have received endorsement from about 87 organizations for the work that we've done. So it basically started as a movement to show a solidified action against anti-xenophobia and Afrophobic protests that have been happening all around the country.
Let's move on to Cape Town specifically, if we can. Your statement effectively says the airport is no longer safe for e-hailing drivers or passengers. Indipili, is that genuinely the situation that exists right now? What is happening?
That is genuinely the situation that exists right now. We have been in communication with Yusuf from the Western Cape e-hailing association, and they have been trying to be a mediator with the Airports Company of South Africa, as well as SAPS, regarding the safety and the lack of a proper regulation of how e-hailing service providers are able to use the staging area and the protection that they should be afforded as members of society and working people. However, there have been incidents over the last few weeks where e-hailing drivers have experienced threats and their lives have been put at risk as outside actors have kind of taken the recent unrest that's been happening around the country and used that as an opportunity to target e-hailing drivers. And now, as a result, the valid concerns that e-hailing drivers had put to the table through the mediation process with ACSA and SAPS, none of that is going to be taken seriously anymore, particularly when fingers start being pointed towards certain groups. So essentially, we're calling for the safety of all e-hailing drivers registered and those who have permits to operate in the area, and to ensure that ACSA and SAPS provide the level of security that they would provide to any other working person in the country.
I want to come back to that phrase, outside actors, if I can. Your statement also refers to armed or masked individuals intimidating and assaulting drivers. Who are these people and who, if anyone, to your best knowledge, is organizing them?
At this point, we don't know. We don't know either, so we can't even point out to say it's this specific group. But even then, that would be putting the people that we're standing with in jeopardy, and also creating even more division. So we can't really cast assertions and say it's these specific people. And that is the information that we have as well. We have received reports that it could be people who are unhappy with how the e-hailing services are provided or conducted, but there is no surety because we don't know. However, regardless of that, e-hailing service providers should not feel threatened and intimidated and fear for their lives when they are carrying out their duties.
You also place blame on Uber, accusing the organization of flooding the airport with drivers while failing to provide adequate facilities. I'd like to know why that's Uber's responsibility rather than simply a problem of too many operators, perhaps chasing too little business.
I mean, Uber is the big company that a lot of e-hailing service providers are registered with, which means it should be their responsibility to ensure that the drivers that they accept to be using the platform are verified and have the valid permits that they need to be able to transport passengers on the road. That should be their role as a main employer, so to speak. And then the security measures and safety and proper working services should come with collaboration from ACSA as well as SAPS to kind of work together to ensure that the people who are registered on the Uber platform and have the correct details and registration and verification are actually allowed to carry out the transport duties under the Uber banner.
So if Uber reduced the number of drivers allowed into that precinct, would your members accept restrictions on access and therefore potentially on their ability to earn?
What we're asking Uber to do is to ensure that all of the drivers that they accept onto the platform are properly verified and that they have the proper credentials to be using the platform. So if they're just accepting a large number of drivers onto the platform without proper verification processes, then that creates an opportunity for unverified drivers to take over the space. And we potentially have risks of threats and violence against verified drivers without being able to follow who exactly incited whatever violence or threatening behavior.
You also accuse the Airports Company South Africa of, and I quote, abandoning its custodial responsibility. What specifically should AXA have done that it's failed to do?
In general, if AXA is going to be allowing e-hailing service providers onto the property to provide very much needed transport to its customers, which are people who are traveling through Cape Town International Airport, they should ensure that the space surrounding the airport is safe enough for e-hailing drivers to be able to wait for potential passengers and to drop them off without feeling like their lives are under threat, and to be able to follow procedure when that is not the case, by ensuring that law enforcement and the South African police services are brought into the situation to ensure the safety of not only the e-hailing service providers, but that of the passengers that they're transporting.
And let me pick you up on that final point then, and a quick answer, because time is against us. You want AXA, SAPS and the Mobility Department to take physical and administrative control of the staging area. What does that mean in practical terms at the airport gate?
In practical terms, that means 24-hour CCTV coverage so that you're able to see who's coming in and who's coming out, ensuring that e-hailing service providers are vetted and verified to be on the property, and provide basic worker rights such as proper ablution services and safety within that area by providing additional security to ensure that people's vehicles are safe, that people who are within their vehicles waiting for potential passengers are safe, and that their human rights are upheld as working individuals within this country.
Thank you very much indeed. That's the view of Indipili Matini, who's organizing committee member of the entity Operation Ubuntu. We will also reach out to Uber and to AXA, the airports company in South Africa, to get their perspective. Indipili, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
For South African exporters, access to Europe is no longer just about price, quality, and tariffs. Increasingly, it's about being able to prove exactly what sits inside your supply chain. What am I talking about? Well, everything from carbon emissions to labor practices. And with the EU's carbon border adjustment mechanism now in force, that could become a serious commercial threat for carbon-intensive South African exporters. So let's put some flesh on the bones on this story. Scott Williams is with us, Director of Business Sustainability at Forvis Mazars South Africa. Scott, welcome back to the program. Is the European Union then effectively putting up a new trade barrier against South African exporters, given those new demands?
One could see it that way. Certainly not looking at South Africa in isolation, but really outside of the EU. The EU are looking to equalize the playing field, or level the playing field when it comes to carbon-intensive products like iron, steel, aluminium, cement, etc. Within the EU, there are existing, you know, prices with their emissions trading scheme that EU-based suppliers are, you know, in scope for. And the CBAM initiative, Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, really is looking to level that playing field, as I say, by putting similar tariffs, if you like, onto non-EU suppliers based on the direct carbon and indirect carbon emissions attached to these products to really level the playing field for EU suppliers. So yes, it is a challenge for South African exporters into the EU, that's for sure.
And it's a big challenge because, as I understand it, 98% of our exports currently enter duty-free. How much of that advantage then could CBAM actually wipe out?
So it's really looking at specific sectors right now, specific products: iron, steel, aluminium, cement, fertilizers, hydrogen, electricity. Some of those much more applicable to South African, you know, the South African exports to the EU than others. But I do feel that, you know, CBAM is a new initiative. It only became fully enacted and active in 2026. And I do think further products will be added to it. And I'm sure that, you know, some of those, as they are, will be highly relevant to South African exporters as well, be it from other large-scale commodities, agricultural produce, perhaps. So it's going to have, if anything, an increasing impact on South African exporters rather than a decreasing impact in the next few years.
And our coal-heavy electricity system does make South African products, therefore, structurally less competitive in Europe. But the problem here is, can an exporter realistically fix that problem if Eskom's generation mix is largely out of its control? It's a real conundrum.
It is a real conundrum, yes, because as you say, our energy mix from Eskom is highly coal-intensive. And compared to some non-EU rivals who will also be exporting products to the EU, it does put South African producers at a disadvantage. We've seen in areas like the mining sector and other industries, our companies trying to reduce their reliance on Eskom through their own renewable energy infrastructure, be that solar on land that they have at mining sites, or other examples as well. But you know, those are more isolated examples, I would say, and on a broader scale, yes, the Eskom grid composition presents a huge challenge for South African companies looking to send their product to the EU.
You argue that transparency is becoming a condition of market access, all well and good, so there will be specific data that European buyers will demand. I guess the question is, how many South African businesses can produce that information when asked for it?
So, yeah. Another big challenge, and you know, I think if we look at our GSE top 40 and our largest listed companies, they typically already have strong data on their environmental footprint, also their social and labor practices, human rights, etc., across, certainly if not their entire supply chain, across the major components of their supply chain. I think the risk and the challenge lies at the level just below that. So our perhaps our listed companies who are not of that, you know, top 40, top 100 scale, and also our large private companies who, you know, do have a lot of export to the EU as well, and other markets where even if it's not a regulation or a legislated demand, they want to know about the provenance of what they are buying in terms of the environmental footprint and social impacts, your labor rights, human rights, especially if core components or initial ingredients, if you want to call them that, are coming from areas where there is a known issue with human rights or labor rights, which can be the case across aspects, across the African continent.
Is there a danger that smaller exporters could be locked out because compliance is too onerous and complex and expensive?
Yes, I think there is a risk of that, Jeremy. I think the way that companies get to grips with that risk, especially those smaller exporters, is through that transparency, is through direct communication with customers in the EU or other areas where this kind of information is needed and demanded, and really starting to work on a plan, a timeline of how they can get to where they need to be to satisfy those customers' demands. And, you know, I always say start now. You can take it in bite-sized chunks if there's a lot of work to do. And really the key thing is not to take the old ostrich approach of bury your head in the sand and hope that this goes away, because the reality is that it won't.
Fair point. So what would inform that plan immediately then if you're going to tackle it in bite-sized chunks?
Okay, so I think immediately would be engaging with your largest customers where they have these demands and getting the exact specifics of what they need. Once you have that kind of lay of the land or understanding of what the requirements are, you can then, you know, work with a consulting partner to understand what is the low-hanging fruit, what areas can I immediately address without too much effort or expense, and what are those areas that are going to be intensive, will take me a bit longer, and where I need some more help, and almost coming up with that very detailed plan on how you're going to address it. And that's actually something in my experience that those customers welcome. If they can see that you have a tangible plan, you've got action points and you can monitor it, they really are willing to engage and work with you, in my experience.
Just a final question. If I'm an exporter, I might be asking myself, at what point does legitimate climate regulation, such as we're talking about, start looking like green protectionism?
Yeah, it's a very, very valid question, and we could open Pandora's box going through that one. I do think there is definitely a strong element of protectionism of EU industrial producers as a result of things like CBAM and even the broader sustainability reporting requirements within the EU. I think that is a very fair comment. I think for South African industries and South African producers, the key thing is then thinking, you know, what does this mean for my long-term strategy? Is it going to be an obstacle which is almost immovable and difficult to get over, or can I adjust my approach and how do I do it proactively to make sure that I'm not left behind and I don't lose key customers and key markets? It's not a one size fits all. I think every company has to look at it in their own circumstances, I guess.
Scott Williams, thank you very much indeed. You're the Director of Business Sustainability at Forvis Mazars South Africa. Building wealth doesn't happen by chance. It happens by making the right decisions. Join John Manike from Old Mutual at the MoneyWeb Economy and Investing Conference at the Money Summit as he shares practical strategies for building long-term wealth, avoiding common investment mistakes, and creating lasting financial success in the real world. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Center. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. Secure your seat today. Go to moneyweb.co.za and start building a stronger financial future.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South African companies looking to do business in China are being warned that protecting the brand may need to happen before selling the product. Now, as I understand it, from January next year, tougher Chinese trademark laws will give authorities greater power to cancel bad faith and unused registrations. But the danger of someone else registering your name first has not disappeared. Well, let's discuss this in a little more detail. Director at Worksman's Attorneys is Donwe Wagerski. Donwe, a very warm welcome to you. So explain this to me. If a South African company wants to enter China, should it register its trademark before it does almost anything else? Is that the advice?
Hi there, Jeremy. Yes, that is definitely the advice. So what is happening as of January 2027 is that China's introduced another revision to their trademark laws, whereby there's going to be several procedural and administrative changes. And one of the points that stand out for me is the state's appetite to intervene.
So if someone gets there first, and we can talk about the appetite to intervene in just a moment, if someone gets there first, you can effectively lose control of your own brand in China. It's as simple and as big as that, I guess.
Well, the danger is that, so if we were to look at stats, for example, China has about 45% of the world's filings. So to put that into perspective, the next in line is the US, which is at 5%. So there's currently about 53 million registrations sitting on those registers. And what is required is if you enter into China, they're quite stringent with regards to customs clearances. And with regards to authorizations, your distributors. And if you don't have that right, if you don't have that protected right, you might not be able to trade.
So how serious then could the consequences be? Could a South African company actually find its own branded product stopped at Chinese customs because someone has registered the name?
That is the danger, yes, absolutely. And then obviously, when you are doing your homework and you're filing your trademarks, more often than not, we do find that trademarks have been registered by somebody that's not authorized to do so, which obviously presents an issue for you. So in the past and currently under revision again are bad faith registrations, whereby if somebody's not authorized, you can then challenge that registration. So what's happening now with the new introductions is that the state will also be able to challenge those bad faith registrations. And if they believe that there's no legitimate reason for that mark being on the register, they can actually revoke that registration.
So does that genuinely change the balance of power then for legitimate brand owners, do you think?
I think that this is quite a hefty introduction, in that it's quite clear that the Chinese authorities are doing a cleaning up exercise. On the one hand, it does protect those that are registering and filing trademarks that are legitimate. And obviously, on the other hand, if you're not using or if somebody is hoarding, for example, that would help in clearing and cleaning up the register.
The reforms, and let's just push that out a little further. The reforms also target trademarks that haven't been genuinely used for 3 years. Conceivably, those have been hoarded as well. Donve, does that mean companies can no longer register dozens of defensive trademarks and simply sit on them, as has patently happened in the past?
Well, what happens in most jurisdictions, that is, a trademark is vulnerable to cancellation. In some territories, it's 5 years. In China, that period is actually 3 years from registration. So your trademark is vulnerable if it hasn't been used. What is great, though, is that they are introducing a provision whereby they recognize online use. So if you are selling on online platforms or using on social media, for example, that evidence of use is going to help you in the event that you find yourself under the threat of cancellation.
As far as these changes are concerned, how widely known are they in South Africa, or do you suspect that some companies operating or about to operate in China are in for a rude shock?
Well, it's all new territory for all of us. And what I have seen is obviously, as experience tells, experience shows, we're going to see what the registry does and how the different parties are treated. And then obviously they're also going to be regulated by regulations that still need to come into effect. So yes, I think the message is do your homework, make sure that your portfolio is in line and your portfolio is in order. If you haven't filed those trademarks, file those trademarks. Make sure that you've got evidence of use, good record keeping.
How expensive is it then to fight to recover a stolen trademark?
It can get expensive in that, well, I suppose it depends where we go to. If we before the registry, you're looking at probably 20,000 to 30,000 rand for proceedings. But then obviously, if you were to challenge it further, that could end up being going to court and obviously long periods of time. And in the meantime, you might have reluctant distributors and reluctant importers.
Donde, a little earlier, you used the phrase genuine use. What is genuine use and who decides or what constitutes it? I think you also referenced a website or an online sale or even social media advertising. Is that enough to pass muster in that respect?
It's always going to be a question of fact. And I think the main priority or premise when filing a trademark is there should be a bona fide intention to use that trademark, which is always going to be the foundation when looking at whether a mark has been used. So let's say, for example, you have a trademark for a wine. Is that trademark genuinely being used for wine?
And what about a smaller South African company, maybe without a large legal budget? What's the lesson here? Prevention, I guess, is going to be vastly cheaper than trying to fight a trademark dispute later.
Prevention is always better than cure, as they say. And I think with all these, with any territory, it doesn't really matter where you're exporting to or where you're active. Always needs to be kept in mind that a trademark is territory specific, class specific. So you need to ensure that your artwork, your logo is up to date, ensure that your primary markets are covered, your primary marks are up to date, and yes, good record keeping.
As is the lesson with everything in life, I guess. Donvey Wagurski, thank you very much indeed. You are a director at Worksman's Attorneys. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, being a woman comes with unavoidable costs, from menstrual products and reproductive health to menopause and personal safety. And one new South African startup says those expenses can add up to more than 300,000 rand over a reproductive lifetime. Monalisa Zwambila is the founder and chief executive officer of Femio. It's a new femtech platform designed, as I understand it, to measure that spending and then turn that into greater financial leverage for women. Monalisa, welcome to you. So are you arguing that simply being female carries a measurable financial penalty?
It absolutely does. And it's a conversation and a cost that is almost invisible because it's one we never talk about. But by virtue of our biology as women, we definitely have a cost, a gendered cost that men don't have, that we have. And so when we go as far as talking about gender equality or talk about the gender pay gap, we actually also need to consider this cost that exists by virtue of our biology.
Your early estimate is around 900 rand a month. What exactly then are you counting in that number?
That 900 obviously will vary depending on the individual, but what we've looked at, we've worked with a data scientist who's helped us really just look at average costs of your sanitary products, be they tampons, sanitary. So we've gone into quite a bit of detail on the calculator. We also look at reproductive costs, which obviously could be gynae visits and contraceptives. We've looked at costs for menopause, another area of women's health that's not considered often enough. We've looked at what those costs are, costs of safety, and then basic, very basic femme, which is your hair and makeup. And if you calculate that out, we're looking, the data is showing that the average cost is around 900 rand a month. And obviously the extrapolation of that can come up to over 300,000 in your reproductive life span.
Within that calculus then, where do you draw the line between genuinely unavoidable biological costs, as you've outlined to me, and simple ordinary consumer spending?
We've given that a lot of thought. I mean, all the ones related to a woman's biology, I think, are undisputable. And what we have done is just look at sort of societal norms and requirements when we look at fem basics. So I think any woman who steps out of her house has to have her hair done and, sort of basic makeup to be able to go for a job interview and to be able to show up in society. And so we've kept those at a minimum. And then costs for safety, we've tried to look at a cost based on what women pay as a premium for their safety. And that's really how we've looked at it.
We can come back to the numbers in a moment if we have time, but let's look at the entrepreneurial side of this platform. What sparked it? What was the genesis?
I'm an entrepreneur and have been for close to 20 years, which has just flown by. But, you know, what sparked it once again, when we look at the numbers in terms of entrepreneurs that are women, you know, those numbers are quite low. And what we're trying to build with Femio is a marketplace for women. So almost trying to create a circular economy where we have women who buy from other women. And in so doing, we can really see how we benefit women-owned businesses. And so on the app, there's also an opportunity for women-owned businesses to profile their organization on the platform, and they have a readily available female market, you know, to show their business to. I mean, my dream is that soon women will be looking for a woman-owned business, and they'll say, "Just Femio it. You'll find a woman-owned business on the platform."
You say that Femio can turn spending power into rewards and savings. Explain that to me, and where does the money ultimately come from?
So once you've calculated your cost, Femio really does everything it can to get you that money back. And that's how we seek to close the gender inequality gap. And we have to do that with partners. We're already in discussions with quite a few, from banking, insurance. We're speaking with pharmacies and retailers. And obviously, we understand that the more women on the platform, the more likely we are to get those partners on board. But ultimately, we believe that the value women create, they need to get something back for that. And we know, you know, Jeremy, as you'd know, I think women make close to 65-70% of all purchase decisions. So we know they have that buying power, and we just want to find ways to get brands and businesses, you know, to really help support women when it comes to rewards.
Mona Lisa, as the father of two adult daughters, this is their question and not mine. Do the costs come down over time? And what changes as you get older?
The costs don't come down over time. I think what's interesting is that obviously you reach menopause around 49, 50. And thereafter, it's costs for menopause, which also are quite high. But what's interesting, Jeremy, is this reality that if you are putting 900 Rand a month into your cost of being a woman, you are not saving that money. And what we've also done is actually showcase that, and obviously really basic calculations, we haven't worked with an actuary as yet, but that 900 Rand over a 28-year period, you know, if you had invested that with a basic sort of 5% compound interest, you can imagine the value lost just by virtue of your biology.
I understand any entrepreneur, and in this case, it would be your ambition to build a commercially successful platform. But I'm sensing that you want to also use the data to influence public policy around the economic cost carried by women. That, Mona Lisa, is a big ask, though.
It's a massive ask. I mean, I think the app in itself is quite audacious. But, you know, once again, it's this belief in the collective that women at scale actually have power. And so there's another section on the portal, which we haven't launched yet. This is obviously an MVP that we're putting to market. But it's another tool that we want to have where women are able to lobby for policy change. If, you know, the dream is that we have a million women on the platform, we should all be able to lobby SARS to make tampons, you know, zero rated from a VAT perspective. And so ideally, the more women on the platform, we can look for issues that are important to us, and we can collectively lobby or petition for change in those areas.
Early days, but reaction so far?
The reaction's been, you know, amazing. We obviously did a lot of research. I took nothing for granted at the start of, you know, building the app. But the reaction's been phenomenal. We had a live launch where we had close to 80 women attend, everything from, you know, marketers. We had a couple of funders. And it really does seem to resonate with women at large. I think our biggest task is to get the word out there so we can get women to start downloading.
Mona Lisa Zwambila, thank you very much indeed. You are the founder and chief executive officer of Femio, as we've been discussing, a new femtech platform designed to measure spending and turn that into greater financial leverage for women. Thank you very much indeed. And on that note, we are going to bid you farewell. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.